Okay, let's begin again. The time is 4:06 p.m. Next item on the title board's agenda is 2009-2010 number 54, Juveniles Tried as Adults Eligible for Community Corrections. Mr. Ramey, on behalf of proponents.
Yes, Edward Ramey. Mr. Hobbs, on behalf of the proponents. And I think what I'd request is, I think we could do 54, 55, and 56 all together to save a little time.
Okay.
The board would like to 54, 55, and 56 break out a couple components.
Could you just, it's been a while since I've looked at these, could you just tell me the differences among them? Guide me through them.
They all involve efforts to direct. Let me start philosophically, aerially, and then come down to the specific points. They are directed to attempting to make the corrections process for people who committed crimes when they were juveniles more directed at the rehabilitative components, reflective of the fact that they were juveniles when they committed the offenses. Taking them in sort of reverse, what number 55 does in that regard is address the issue on the front end, and it would repeal completely the statute which allows for direct filing by district attorneys against juveniles for certain offenses in district court. It maintains, however, the ability of a juvenile court judge upon request of a district attorney to transfer certain offenses up to the district court. But the direct file, as distinguished from the transfer authority of the juvenile court, would be repealed under 55. What number 56 does is address the issue on the other end, and that is that it would add an eligibility component in the discretion of the Department of Corrections, that once someone who was sentenced as an adult, either through direct file or transfer, and is serving time, therefore charged and convicted as an adult, and is serving time, therefore, with the Department of Corrections, that upon reaching the age of 30, the offender, to use the proper word, if he has displayed or she has displayed acceptable institutional behavior, which is a determination to be made by the Department of Corrections, if they determine that he or she has, can then be placed in community corrections, which is more rehabilitative, we believe, at least, more rehabilitative process than continuing to stay in the normal prison setting. 54 combines the two of those. I know what the first question coming is, but at any rate, that's how they work. 54 is a combination of those two.
Mr. Domenico?
No, just to actually jump in, make sure that you and the proponents are comfortable with my sitting on the board.
Absolutely.
Even though our office, the Attorney General, to be specific, has taken a position on similar bills in the legislature.
Mr. Domenico, if you have no problem, I am.
All right. Well, I'll remain.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Ramey concerning 54, 55, or 56? Ms. Eubanks?
Mr. Ramey, and these questions arise because generally I don't deal in criminal law, and two, the terminology that appears in some of the staff drafts confuses me, and so I just want to make sure the staff drafts continually refer to adult district courts, and
yeah.
I've just always thought of district court as district court, and a person,
sure.
A juvenile may be charged as an adult in district court. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, there's no separate adult district court as opposed to a juvenile district court. In most jurisdictions, however, the juvenile court is just a division of the district court.
Okay, thank you.
But yeah, that was a strange.
Yeah, okay.
Any other questions? If not, then let's turn to the question of single subject. Do we have anybody signed up for any of these three measures? For or against, actually, Mr. Ramey. So, okay. So any discussion by the board on whether these measures comprise a single subject? Ms. Eubanks?
I would be interested in knowing Mr. Ramey's thoughts on the single subject on 54, what you think the single subject of 54 is.
That's the question I knew was coming.
Oh, okay.
You know, 54 does raise an issue because we're doing two things there, repealing direct file and dealing with eligibility. The concept is, I think what I tried to state a little in our the purpose of this, the subject of, let me just address 54 by itself, is to make the correctional process more directed in a rehabilitative fashion suitable for someone who has committed a serious offense. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in the correction system anyway. A serious offense as a juvenile. And we're coming from both ends of it. The first part of it is to have jurisdiction rest with the juvenile court judge as to whether a matter should be transferred to the district court at all, and therefore go into the correction system if we formally view as spending time in prison. The other end of it is addressed in the community corrections piece. Then again, what community corrections is a program whereby an offender, to use that term, still serving his or her sentence, but not inside the walls of the prison, out in the community. Usually, community corrections comes into play. It's very helpful, by the way, in transitioning a person from prison life back into community life. Usually comes toward the end of a sentence when that transition becomes. It is, therefore, much more rehabilitative. What we've tried to do is add, again, with a discretionary for the department itself, that if the offender has deported himself or herself appropriately, they can get into that process much earlier than they would had they not been convicted of an offense while they were juvenile. So both of those concepts are directed at molding the correctional process into a rehabilitative. Having said that, I also understand that we're doing two different things to accomplish that in 54, and we split them out.
And I guess, you know, I'll tell you up front, although, you know, if we get to the point of setting a title, I don't think the single subject as stated in the staff draft covers it. Because if I understand correctly, in terms of the authority to charge a juvenile as an adult, if that being removed, then we're not talking about a juvenile who's been tried as an adult, because you're removing the authority to do, I mean, so I assume the one provision is to keep juveniles from...
Not necessarily. We're not removing the prospect that a person who commits a crime while he or she was a juvenile would, in fact, be tried as an adult and sentenced as an adult. But we're eliminating or seeking to repeal the ability of the district attorneys to make that filing directly, as opposed to submitting that question to the juvenile court to determine whether the matter should be transferred from juvenile court to district court. But if the juvenile court agrees to a transfer to district court, it goes to district court, and then the juvenile will be tried as an adult and sentenced as an adult.
But it seems possible that repealing the district attorney's authority, if the juvenile court chooses not to transfer the juvenile to district court, then the juvenile won't be tried as an adult.
That's correct.
And the single subject is talking about juveniles who are tried as adults.
Right.
And so if the prospect is that this is affecting juveniles that won't be tried as adults, and that's why I say if we get to setting a title, I think I have an issue with how we try to describe your single subject. But I wanted to hear how you described your single subject.
I would agree with you on 54 in particular, which I'm now looking at the title.
I don't know that I have, you know, because you've broken out the two components in 55 and 56.
Correct.
I don't have concerns on single subject grounds with those, but.
I take your point on 54. I think there would have to be a revision to that. 54 would affect more than juveniles tried as adults.
Because I assume there'll be some that won't be tried as adults as a result of that.
Exactly.
At least potentially.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there anybody, again, anybody who wishes to testify on whether these three measures comply with the single subject requirement? If not, then is there discussion by the board or a motion? We should do, and we should do them, I think, one at a time. And it seemed to me that number 54, is, of course, is the one that raises the potential issue, although I think Mr. Ramey connected the two different provisions in my mind, so I don't think it's log rolling or two separate and distinct subjects. Even though I think Ms. Eubanks is correct, I'm not quite sure how we would express it in the title, but it seems to me that, that 54 is a single subject. For purposes of discussion, I'll make a motion that the board find that number 54 is a single subject and that we proceed to set titles.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Shall we go ahead and do the others? Okay, then number 55, which is probably clearer, I'll go ahead and make a motion that the board find that number 55 is a single subject and that we proceed to set titles.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Domenico. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And then for number 56, similarly, I'll move that the board find that number 56 comprises a single subject and that we proceed to set titles.
Second.
Seconded by Ms. Eubanks. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. That motion carries 3-0. Then let's go back to number 54 and start with the staff draft, which Ms. Gomez is displaying on the screen. Ms. Eubanks has already raised one question about the staff draft. Mr. Ramey, do you have any other comments about the staff draft? Any concerns?
I think the staff draft is otherwise accurate, but I think Ms. Eubanks' question is very apropos. I'm wondering the easiest way. I think it's easily fixable.
We're open to suggestions.
Let me give a little background. Offenders is the sort of the statutory term. Little too glib.
Concerning the process of charging and trying juveniles as adults.
Then you have the 54 at the other end of the spectrum, which is the.
Yeah,
you get
that's
out
true.
Early.
I guess that's not part of charging and trying treatment.
I think everything after that. I don't know what else to do.
Concerning juveniles who may be tried as adults?
Or concerning the treatment of juvenile? I don't know if that really gets to the DA's authority. Well.
I
Is it important, the concept that they're juveniles charged with committing a crime? I mean, it's implied with, you know, being tried, but for the citizens, they may not understand that connection. I think it's probably more obvious for us. For juveniles charged with crimes.
Charged with or convicted of crimes?
Not necessarily convicted, because we've got...
Well, the second part only applies to people who are convicted.
Because Eubanks is going in a direction that may work.
I mean,
it covers juveniles charged with crimes.
Concerning juveniles charged with committing a crime for which they may be tried as an adult?
That's good. That's better still.
That's pretty good.
We want to at least put it up there. I think we want to strike the language after juvenile, so strike who are tried and substitute charged with committing a crime for which they may be tried I don't know. It doesn't seem right to have adults plural, so they may be tried as an adult, so insert an and make adults singular. I mean, I know juvenile,
I think it's better plural.
Okay.
And if you're concerned about going back and forth, the place to change it would be
a juvenile.
No.
No.
It would be charged with committing crimes, but I.
Okay. And I don't know whether it's important to say in district court or not.
I don't think that
means much to most people. So strike in district court.
And delete adult in 4.
Yeah. There's also an adult on line 7 before district court that needs to be stricken.
Juvenile wasn't convicted in district court when the inmate was a juvenile. He was necessarily, might have been, but he was convicted for a crime committed when he was a juvenile. And he actually could be an adult by the time he's tried.
Now, again, maybe we've just dropped the whole district court idea because, again, I don't think that's what's meaningful for voters, that perhaps in regard to the district attorney's authority, we want to say to directly file charges against a juvenile as an adult. So maybe we struck the wrong word. So strike in district court, yeah, undo. So strike in and insert as an, and then strike district court. And down on line seven, undo what we did. And strike in adult district court. I think you want to take the N also, IN? Do we need to say a crime, or is it sufficient just to say when was convicted when the...
Well, I think to address the specific comment Mr. Ramey made, you're going to have to change that language a little bit, okay. I think, to reflect. I guess my point is, I don't think you need to do it there, but you're going to have to do it later. Convicted as an adult for a crime committed when the inmate was a juvenile, I think is what it's going to end up having to say down there. Was, and I don't think that addresses what you said. Convicted as an adult for a crime committed when the inmate...
Okay, so after the stricken language, insert as an adult for a crime committed... Is that the concept? No.
I'm a little concerned about taking it out in line four. I think it's good below. Now it would read, repealing a district attorney's authority to directly file charges against a juvenile as an adult. That's accurate, but it might overstate things too. I'm not sure. I mean, directly file is a term of art, I think. District attorneys can still file charges against a juvenile. They just have to do it in juvenile court. As an adult,
court, do you want to restore, or do you want to just say in district?
I would either put it back the way it was, or add, or leave what you added, and also put in district court.
So let's restore district court. And before district, insert in.
I think that's a little better.
I agree. Filing,
right?
You're absolutely right.
Most it's of sort of assumed a lot of knowledge, I think.
I'm going to ask one other question on line seven. Technically, about asking about the word convicted as an adult, I think technically, isn't it sentenced as an adult?
Yes. Probably better.
What the measure seems to say, I think. And
actually, the operative language is part of what's repealed. I'll verify what you're saying is correct.
And it refers to 19.2.5.17.3A1, which says the district judge shall sentence the juvenile as follows, one, as an adult.
Yes.
Okay.
So maybe if we could incorporate, yeah, says the change convicted to sentenced. Any other changes? So is there a motion to adopt these changes, to adopt the staff draft as amended by those changes? If we can we go directly to that?
Can we read it clean first?
But just for the sake of the record, too, I'll read it. An amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning juveniles charged with committing a crime for which they may be tried as adults, semicolon, maybe that should be a comma instead of a semicolon, and comma in connection therewith, comma, repealing a district attorney's authority to directly file charges against a juvenile as an adult in district court, semicolon, and directing the executive director of the Department of Corrections to refer an inmate to a community corrections program if the inmate is at least 30 years of age, comma, has displayed acceptable institutional behavior, comma, and was sentenced as an adult for a crime committed when the inmate was a juvenile.
I move to adopt the staff draft as amended.
Second.
Seconded by Ms. Eubanks. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 54. The time is 4:33 p.m. Let's then move to number 55, which the staff draft is displayed on the screen. We've already found it to be a single subject. Changes to the staff draft. Ms. Eubanks?
Consistent with what we just did, I think on line 2 we want to strike in. Substitute as an. And then before district, insert in. And then we have our concerning phrases, but it just seems like concerning the repeal, whether we could just say an amendment repealing.
I'm okay with that.
A district attorney's authority.
Sounds good.
So to strike concerning the repeal of and substitute repealing. I would move both of those changes.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
That motion carries 3-0. Motion to adopt the staff draft as amended.
So moved.
Second.
And it would read, an amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes repealing a district attorney's authority to directly file charges against a juvenile as an adult in district court. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
No. That motion carries 3-0. Then, and that completes action on number 55, and the time is 4:35. Then number 56, we found to be a single subject. Ms. Gomez is displaying the staff draft on the screen in the room. Any changes to the staff draft?
Sure.
Ms. Eubanks, I'm sorry.
You're fine. First of all, I think in terms of the beginning phrase, again, since it's concerning direction to, we can just say strike concerning direction to and substitute directing. And then starting on line 4, want to strike convicted in and substitute sentenced as an, and then before district, strike district court, and insert for a crime committed I would move those changes.
Second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
That motion carries 3-0. Is there a motion to adopt the staff draft as amended?
So moved.
Second. So then it would read an amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes directing the Executive Director of the Department of Corrections to refer an inmate to a community corrections program if the inmate is at least 30 years of age, comma, has displayed acceptable institutional behavior, comma, and was sentenced as an adult for a crime committed when the inmate was a juvenile. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 56, and the time is 4:37 p.m. Thank you. So, let's go to the next item on the board's agenda, 2009-2010, number 61, interest rate on deferred deposit loan. Mr. Ramey, are you?
I think, Mr. Hobbs, if board's pleasure, we could take 61, 62, and 63 together, and I am Edward Ramey representing three. They are virtually identical except for the interest rate in each one.
So for discussion, let's take 61, 62, and 63 together. And again, perhaps if you could just, for at least for my memory refreshing, remind me what they're doing and what the differences are.
Nothing to do with renewable energy. I guarantee you that. What these three measures attempt to do is limit the finance charge that can be made on a deferred deposit loan, or payday loan, as it's colloquially known. It, in the different percentages of each measure, and there are provisions in there. Avoid attempt to evade efforts to evade the restrictions on the finance charge.
Ms. Eubanks.
Mr. Ramey, could you explain to me the changes that are made in, I believe, Section 4 of the measure? It's relating to the amount of the loan, I mean, and how that relates to capping the interest rate?
The problem that this actually resulted from a discussion at the excuse me, I'm mumbling today and I apologize, review and comment hearing. If we limit the finance charges as we are doing in the previous sections of and prohibit any other charges being made in connection with it, then the cap that existed under current 106, limiting the amount financed $500 by any one consumer, and the cap of $575 becomes meaningless. And actually, this doesn't make sense. Where those caps, as it has been explained to me and as was discussed at the review and comment hearing, came from is under the prior regime, the way it was worded before using the finance charge, which is the fine term definition, various other charges could be piled on what was theretofore as an interest rate. And the point of existing 106 is to say you could do that, but only the face amount of the interest rate. Having done what we've done, the change to 106 is nothing but a conforming amendment. Language in there doesn't have any, that we have stricken, has no meaning after we have limited the finance charge and prohibited any other charge. solely designed to be a conforming amendment. I will acknowledge, we totally didn't think of it at all when we came to Lynch House. Aaron, I think it was an importance. It's a conforming amendment that probably should be made.
Thank you.
Any other questions of the proponents concerning 61, 62, or 63? If not, then let's turn to the question of whether the measures comply with the single subject requirement. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on that issue? Mr. Dunn?
Good afternoon. For the record, Jason Dunn, Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck. I'm here on behalf of the Colorado Financial Services Centers Association. And Ron Rockvam, who is president of the association and a Colorado elector. It's good to be here on Ed Ramey Day at Title Board as well. our issue is not so much on single subject, but rather on the jurisdiction of the board to hear the measure. As this board knows, Article 5 and Section 140.105.2 prohibit the board from hearing any measure where there has been changes made to the measure after the review and comment hearing that were not in direct response to questions or comments made at the review and comment hearing. In this case, two such changes occurred here, and as a result, this board does not have jurisdiction to hear the matter. What I would like to do is to hand you materials that you really have most of, but that I think will help organizationally as we walk through this. Again, with the exception of one of these documents, these are ones you already have. The first one, obviously, is Section 140.105.2, and I included that just to point out that the strict standard under which the board operates in terms of considering whether it has jurisdiction to consider changes that were made after the review and comment hearing. If you'll turn to tab 2, that is the memorandum provided by legislative staff at the review and comment hearing. And on page 5, and Ms. Eubanks picked up on this. Question 4. Question said, if passed, the change in the allowable interest rate and charges for each deferred deposit loan will change the total amount of the instrument held by the lender. The proponents may wish to make a conforming amendment to Section 5.3.1.106 to reflect this change. Well, I think like Ms. Eubanks asked, the question is, what does that mean? And if you turn to tab 3, I included that provision. And it has three key components. I think it's important to walk through each one of those to understand how they relate to what was done at the review and comment hearing. The first clause says a lender shall not lend an amount greater than $500. So what that is a prohibition on writing a single loan for more than $500. I think that's pretty obvious. The second clause, nor shall the amount financed exceed $500 by any one lender at any time to a consumer. What that is a prohibition on giving a consumer multiple loans if they add up to more than $500. The flip side of that coin, obviously, is that under Colorado law, you can give multiple loans if they do not add up to more than $500 outstanding. And, of course, third, it says no instrument held as a result of a deferred deposit loan shall exceed $575. That, of course, and let me step outside the legal analysis here. The way the industry works is that when a person comes in for a deferred deposit loan, they must have a checking account, and they are asked to write a check on that checking account for the amount of the loan plus the applicable charges. In the case of a $500 loan, the maximum charge, as I think Mr. Ramey talked about, is $575. So what that sentence says is that the most a person can write a check for that they leave with the lender is $575. So in response to the review and comment question about a conforming amendment because of the change from the current formula to an interest rate cap, the proponents of the measure made some changes. And on tab 4, you'll see the redline version of what they did. And if you look, first of all, 3.1106 was not in the original measure, so the entire section's in red because they put in the entire section. So they did two key things. First, as Mr. Ramey talked about, and if you look at the last sentence of the measure of that paragraph, they struck the reference to a prohibition on any instrument exceeding $575. Now, my math is correct. Under the current, under Initiative 61, the 36% interest rate cap, the maximum loan, maximum charge on a $500 loan would be $6.92. So that is what the conforming amendment, I think the staff was talking about. As Mr. Ramey admitted, it's no longer an applicable provision to say the cap is $575 because there would never be such a case. But the conforming amendment would be then to list what that number is. And in this case, for a two-week loan on $500, $506.92. But the proponents went a step further than that and actually struck the entire reference and prohibition on any instrument maximum amount. And that exceeded the review and comment memorandum or the discussion that was had. But more importantly is the strike through above that. As you can see in the redlined version, they struck the provision that said, nor shall the amount financed exceed $500 by any one lender. What that strike through does is change the prohibition on multiple loans that add up to more than $500 to now allowing multiple loans that exceed $500. That's a significant change in the industry, if not a sea change. And but for the interest rate cap, would be enormous to the industry. And if you go back and look again at what the comment was, it was talking about a conforming amendment relative to the maximum amount an instrument can be written for and left with the lender. And finally, at tab 5, I have the transcript of the hearing. And if you turn to page 9 of the transcript, that question is posed verbatim to Mr. Ramey, beginning at line 15. Through 18, I won't repeat the question, but then, 15 through 20, and I won't repeat that, but then Mr. Ramey's response is, that was extremely helpful too and frustrating for me because I'm not sure I could figure out how to calculate what we're doing. So what we're going to do is a conforming amendment to 106, and where we're leaning now is to simply strike that language that imposes that maximum amount. And there was no discussion about changing the prohibition on multiple loans that exceed $500, and therefore the measure violates Section 140.105.2 and Article 5 of the Constitution, and the board lacks jurisdiction on that point. In addition, the proponents made substantial changes, and if you go back to the redline version, tab 4, the second page, they made substantial changes to 3.1.121.2. In the original version of that, there were two paragraphs added, paragraph 2 and 3. And if you look at the red line version in the sections that's deleted, there was substantial changes made. Paragraph 3 was completely withdrawn, and paragraph 2 was almost totally rewritten. Many of the enumerated provisions and prohibitions were eliminated from the measure. Now, there was one discussion of that in the review and comment hearing, and not to cause you guys to jump around too much, but if you look at tab 5 of the transcript, page 4, and Mr. Ramey referenced this, there's a discussion where the review and comment staff is walking through their statement of the purposes, and they list the third purpose as to prohibit evading the provisions of the measure through any artifice, device, or subterfuge, etc. And Mr. Ramey says in response, that's a good statement. The only qualification I think I would make on it, and we will probably clarify this in the language to some degree, is that in connection with the anti-evasion piece, the third item that you just read, we would be restricting those sorts of changes, ancillary or that sort of thing, if made in connection with a deferred deposit loan. Not broader than that, but something that would be associated in some way with the deferred deposit loan. So what, and not to put words in Mr. Ramey's mouth, but I think what he was saying is there need to be a connection between the prohibitions and evading the restrictions in the measure. But there was no discussion of the actual substance of those two paragraphs or any changes. And those neither of those paragraphs came up later in the discussion and review and comment. So for those two reasons, we think the board lacks jurisdiction to review the single subject and title of this measure, and we ask that they remand it back to Legislative Council and Legal Services for a new review and comment hearing.
Questions for Mr. Dunn, Ms. Eubanks?
Just so that I'm clear, at least me trying to follow along, that the arguments you're making in terms of the two changes are applicable to all three measures?
Absolutely.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
Mr. Domenico?
First, I congratulate you on your little booklet. It's
thank you.
You seem to have gone to the Mark Gruskin CLE on opposing initiatives. But on your statement about 106, 3.1106, what is the difference, in your view, between the original version and the changed version made by the strike-through in the first sentence? I think I understood your discussion of the 575.
Right.
But my more serious question is about
right.
the other change.
I think that's the key point, and that's the key violation of the statutory provision. As I said, the way the industry works right now is a person can come into a deferred deposit lender, and they can get a loan, and as the first clause says, it has to be for under $500. A person, before that loan is paid off, that person is allowed to come back under Colorado law and get a second loan, so long as those two outstanding loans, or a third or fourth, do not add up to more than $500. The idea is to prevent, there's a phrase for it, I think it's, well, I can't remember the name of the phrase, but it's basically to prevent people from exceeding the $500 loan prohibition on a single loan by getting a loan one day for $300 and then coming back the next day and getting another loan for $300. So what this says is, yes, you can have the current law says, yes, you can have multiple loans outstanding, but they can't add up to more than $500. With this strike through, that prohibition is gone. Now someone can come in, and as long as each loan doesn't exceed $500, they can get as many loans as they want for whatever total they want.
I guess I need Mr. Ramey to clarify if that's his reading. I think I read the language. Now it would say, a lender shall not lend an amount greater than $500 at any time to a consumer. So if I have a $300 loan, I'm not sure how I could come in and ask for another $300 loan without violating that.
I don't think that's what it says. I think that the new language simply just reverts to a single loan limitation of $500. Now, I thought actually about that argument. Think about what you'd have to do to reach that. First of all, you'd have to read the stricken language as meaningless. Otherwise, it had no purpose if the strike-through did nothing to change the law. And second, you'd have to read the language that remains as encompassing the language that was stricken through beforehand.
Well, I'm not sure. I think the way I would have read the existing version, I guess, is if I come in and have and take out a loan of $500, I'm at my limit. Without this language, with the language, then I couldn't come back and say, hey, I can't pay back my loan right now. And they say, okay, fine, we're gonna roll this over or do some new, we're going to make some kind of new agreement where your original loan, you don't have to pay it back now, but now what your finance, all your finance charges apply not only to the original loan of $500, but also to this X amount of interest or something, some penalty that's added on that wouldn't have been part of the $500 loan, but is now financed. getting rid of that language does say that maybe you might be able to have certain charges that are rolled into the finance, what can be financed. But I think that given the other changes that they're making, that there's that's why they got rid of that. And I think that that is in response. I think that's exactly what the comment was referring to, was trying to suggest that because of these other changes you're making, you might want to get rid of that. But it may be that I don't understand
what's going on. Well, I can say
it,
that wasn't my reading of it. I read it as a reference to the review and comment, a reference to the last sentence. And I think, as Mr. Raymond just explained, that was his reading. And his comment at the hearing attested
right
to that, where he said, we'll strike that maximum limit.
Well, right, but I don't see how you could read the language. Just say you're starting from scratch and you had a sentence in front of you that said, a lender shall not lend an amount greater than $500 at any time to a consumer. I guess you could read that as saying you can do $300 every day.
Absolutely.
For a month straight. And But it seems also to me that's not necessary to read it that way. That you can also read it to say you can't have a loan, you can't loan someone, you can't have outstanding loans of more than $500 at any time, no matter if you break them up or do them at the same time. And the only difference being how much you're financing. So, I don't know, maybe we need Mr. Ramey to clarify exactly what's going on, because I didn't understand him to be saying quite what you're reading. Although I do agree, now that I look at it more carefully, that's, you could read it that way, I suppose.
And I think the key is we're talking about a conforming amendment. So it's conforming to what? It's conforming to the interest rate cap. That's all. That's the single subject that Mr. Ramey says the measure encompasses. So if you're doing something to a provision in that section that's conforming to an interest rate cap, and Mr. Ramey says in response at the hearing that he agreed and that he's going to strike the maximum amount, which the only part of that measure, well, I guess there's two parts where there's an amount. It's the $500 in the first clause, but that's not at issue. And it's the $575 limit on any instrument. Anything beyond that is a change that goes beyond the review and comment memorandum. But I'll let Mr. Ramey provide his points, and then I can come back up.
Any other questions for Mr. Dunn? Then, Mr. Ramey, would you like to respond?
Best I can remember, on all three points. My recollection is clear that we read the provision as Mr. Domenico just stated, and that the intent, and I may not have in the transcript that I'm now reading may not have provided as complete an answer as I should have, but the intent was, the understanding was only one loan could be made at a time. It already said that. We had surplus language already, and the reason we didn't try to compute the 6.5% or 6.25% is that became minimus, it wasn't relevant. So both of the entire change, the entire inclusion of a reference at all to 106 was intended to be responsive to the comment and the review and comment memorandum. That was certainly the goal, and as I read the transcript, I'm not sure I was as clear on the record as I should have been, but that was certainly where we were going with it. In our initial drafts, we didn't have anything in there about it, so it was solely responsive to that. And Mr. Domenico's understanding comports with my reading of, or my understanding at the time and today of the reading of that language. On section 121, the issue that was raised, as I recall, I'm racking my memory a little bit about it in the review and comment memorandum, was, were we affecting things that had no relationship whatsoever? The language that we had in the measures could have been read in our initial draft of the measures to affect practices, products, services, et cetera, offered unrelated to a deferred deposit loan. And the point of the cleanup of that, and I hope I was clear even in the transcript about that, that what we were going to do was make it clear in this anti-evasion language that the only thing we were attempting to address here were product services, anything made in connection with the loan. And if you look at the language we took out, which we had broken into sort of two components, it was not that clear. That's the only reason that we made the changes. That's about all I can say. Both of those changes were in direct response to the review and comment, to the comments made in the review and comment memorandum that Mr. Dunn identified. I'm not sure that my response was coherent at the hearing itself regarding what we were trying to do, but that is, 106 was purely to be a conforming memorandum in response to that one question. And 121 was intended solely to eliminate any concern, to clean up that language, to eliminate any concern we were reaching beyond services or products being made available in some way associated with the deferred deposit. Hope that makes sense. Now that I've been through that experience, I'm going to be extremely itemized everything on the record henceforth. Those were the questions to which funding was due.
Good, thank you. Mr. Dunn?
I did just check with my client. They made a good point that to address Mr. Domenico's point, if a customer comes in and asks for a loan of $500, and it's a two-week loan, and they leave an instrument for $575, they come back 2 weeks later and say, I can't pay this loan, then there is no rolling that into a new loan. They are already at the maximum. They would then go into default. So the logic that there's an attempt to incorporate rolled-over interest charges, if I understand what you were getting at, isn't actually legally or factually possible.
Well, then what... what effect did the stricken language does it have under existing law? The nor shall the amount financed exceed $500 by any one lender.
That's exactly what I said. That they will now be able to write multiple loans to a person in excess that aggregate to more than $500. Prior to this, they were not. So if a person comes in on day one. And they get a $300 loan, they can come back the second day because the first loan's not due for another 13 days, and they can ask for another $300 loan. That was not possible before these changes.
Mr. Dunn, do you think it's possible that the anti-evasion language that's added would cover that? That getting multiple loans could be viewed as evading the $500 limitation?
Well, I don't think so, Mr. Hobbs. I mean, I mean, these are talking about, well, the original draft was talking about other types of products, whether it's consumer, what's the phrase I want in here? Consumer credit counseling and things like that, open-ended transactions, things like that. Ancillary products where they, my guess in reading this, is the original version was that they would say, well, we can't loan you more than this, but we're going to make you pay for this other service, and they would make their money that way. I think that was an attempt to prohibit those types of activities in the original draft. But I think there is no doubt that under the new version of this, if it were to be adopted, that a lender could make multiple loans for more than that aggregate to more than $500 at a given time.
I mean, even though, and you may be right, but I'm still puzzling over the language. As amended, then 106 would say a lender shall not lend an amount greater than $500 at any time to a consumer. And multiple loans that add up to more than $500, it seems to me, might violate that especially if they were intended to evade the $500 limitation by breaking a larger loan into multiple loans, each less than $500.
I suppose an argument could be made that if you came in a single visit to one of the centers and said, I need a bunch of money and I want you to just break it up into chunks right now and let's write several different loans, then perhaps. But that's not the scenario. It's the person who comes in one day for $300, comes back a week later, a week before their first loan is due, and says, you know what, I need another loan. My car broke down, and I need another $300. I mean, that's a legitimate request. That's not an attempt to evade or anything like that. The question is whether that would be prohibited. As I said to Mr. Domenico, if the only way you can read the revised language as prohibiting multiple loans over $500 is to, number one, change, assume that the stricken language was meaningless to begin with, because if it has the same meaning before and after, then the stricken language didn't mean anything, and second, that the first clause was intended to cover multiple loans, and I don't think either of those cases are true.
Okay. So the question that you've raised was whether the changes made were in direct response to the comments of the legislative staff. And the way I'm looking at striking the last sentence of 106 is that is in direct response. Now, it may have been that the legislative staff anticipated that the $575 limit would have been recomputed to a lower amount.
That's our argument.
Right, but certainly proponents could deal with that conforming amendment by simply striking the limitation altogether. That would address the conforming amendment question that legislative staff raised.
I think it would, but it also is a substantive change. It goes one step further than a conforming amendment into a substantive change, because now there is no prohibition. There is no maximum instrument amount listed.
But it is that change is in direct response to a question, because if they didn't strike it, if the proponents didn't strike it, another way to deal with it would be to change the $575 amount.
That's right, and I think those are two different responses. I think one is in direct response, changing the amount. The other one is tangentially related to the topic of discussion, and it's a substantive change to the measure.
Okay, well, I on that one, I probably disagree. It seems to me that even if the way the proponents responded was surprising, it's nevertheless in response to the question. But I don't know what to think about the other change to 106. That I'm having a little more trouble seeing that change was in direct response to the comments from legislative staff.
And if it's helpful, I can have my client, who lives and dies by these statutes, come up and tell you how they think that affects how they practice.
Well, I'm not sure that that's helpful to me. I just want to know if it's in direct response to the comments. I'm not quite sure I've gotten the link. Now, we apply a substantial compliance standard, so if it was substantially compliant with 1-40-105, then I'm going to be okay with it, but I'm not quite sure. I haven't made up my mind on
right. And
that
I,
change.
Am I not correct that the substantial compliance doctrine applies to the elements of the process between review and comment and the title board applicable to having a version that is that shows the amended version, the redline version? I think actually I was listening online this morning. I think that came up with Mr. Gessler. The case law that I've seen on the substantial compliance doctrine was applicable to, I don't have the site in front of me, but I think it's 140, 105, whatever the next section is after the one we've been discussing here, maybe 3 or 4. The case law all reference, I think it's subsection 4. I think all the case law references that section in terms of substantial compliance. I haven't seen case law on the substantive measure, because it's an important step in the process. It not only is important that the proponents of a measure, that citizens who come forward with a measure, have the opportunity to receive feedback from legislative counsel and the experts who are in drafting and constitutional analysis. But it gives the public notice about what's in a measure with ample time before it reaches title board. In this case, there was no notice about the change in the number of payments, the number of loans that can be made under or above $500.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Dunn? Thank you. Mr. Ramey, do you have any other comments based on the discussion so far?
Mr. Hodge, I was a little unclear. You were indicating, I think, that you were more comfortable with one change than the other and were concerned about one of the aspects of 106. Which was which?
The first change to 106, striking the language that reads, nor shall the amount financed exceed $500 by any one lender. I'm having trouble understanding how that was in direct response to the comments of legislative staff.
I thought you were saying it was the other way around, and you were surprised by that, but not the other one.
No, I was trying to say that striking that last sentence of 106 strikes me as a surprising response to the question about a conforming amendment.
Oh.
I would have expected, as I think Mr. Dunn would, that the $575 amount would have been recomputed to a lower amount. But I was just expressing that at least striking the entire sentence was in response to the issue raised by legislative staff, because what do you do with the $575 limit? And the proponents responded by striking it altogether instead of recomputing it. But I'm having more trouble with the change in the preceding sentence, understanding how that was in direct response to the legislative staff comments.
Well, I'm getting a bit of an education, I guess sort of third hand here today, about how the industry views that section as operating prior to that. And I'm not just trying to latch on to Mr. Domenico's comments. I mean, the way that we read it was, in fact, the way Mr. Hunter shot lend an amount greater than $500 at any time to a consumer. And we were talking about conforming. I mean, that was almost surplusage language. It was our understanding, and it may well be that our understanding was incorrect, and that there is an issue, was an issue, at least, about the operative effects of that language. Some other scenarios that I'm hearing are exactly the kind of thing that we were attempting to reach through the anti-evasion language as well. In other words, if you give life to the phrase that Mr. Dunn suggests life should be given to, and therefore allow a deferred deposit lender to make multiple loans, I don't want to say at a point in time, but during a period in time to a particular consumer, what I'm hearing is that, well, that's done regularly in a certain way, but in another way, for example, coming in the same day and signing multiple notes, it's not done. I don't know that. I'll accept his statement as being an accurate representation of the industry, but we certainly want to avoid any evasion of that prescription. So it's sort of a combination of the two. I apologize because my recollection of the drafting phrase is a bit hazy at this particular point, but our understanding of the operative effect was as Mr. Secondly, there were two things we were trying to accomplish: make sure that there was nothing in 106 that was either surplusage, something else in our measure, or antithetical to it. And the two comments that we were responding to were really, on the one hand, that limit. Maybe it was foolish to strike the whole sentence and not calculate the minimum interest rate. Secondly, and this is what I'm struggling to remember, and I can't remember if the first part of that was also in part addressing the clarity of the anti-evasion language and the reach of the anti-evasion language. It may well have been, and I wish I had a precise answer, and the transcript doesn't reveal one way or the other. But the gist, but it would fit very nicely into that. The gist of the entire anti-evasion concept is to do anything else that you want, but if it's associated in any way with the deferred deposit loan, then you can't evade the prescriptions by doing it. And clearly, it was not our intent, just logically, to authorize, by striking the language that we did, to authorize precisely the kinds of things we were seeking to address specifically in the anti-evasion language. I'm not sure we did this as artfully as we should have, but that was certainly the intent, and it was those two concepts in the review and comment hearing and in the memorandum and discussions that were being addressed. One was the inconsistency of language in 106, and the other being what is the scope and focus of this anti-evasion language.
Thank you. Discussion by the board? Ms. Eubanks?
Okay. In terms of the changes made to Section 5, dealing with the unfair or deceptive practices, it's not uncommon, and speaking from experience, it's not uncommon that part of the function of review and comment is setting forth the staff's thoughts as to what the purposes of a proposed initiative is. And there are many times that once the proponents see and hear those purposes as perceived by the staff, they think, oh, no, that's not what we're trying to do. That's much broader, or, you know, that's not what we're trying to accomplish. We're trying to do something different. So I do think that a statement of a purpose that then, based on the transcript provided, that Mr. Ramey responded, oh, gee, we don't mean for it to be this broad. We need to change it to make it more specific to these types of loans. I think, and now it's been changed, I think that change to Section 5 is in response to a comment made during review and comment. And so I don't think that that's reason for the title board to deny jurisdiction to set a title. In regard to the changes made in Section 4, of the measure, in terms of the changes made to the last sentence of 106, I think that when the staff raised the issue in review and comment about a conforming amendment, I don't think that the only conforming amendment that was possible was just changing the dollar amount. I think there was the option for proponents to strike the sentence completely because it is a function of the interest cap that's being imposed by the measure. It's going to control for that amount of loan how much maximum is due and owing on it. And so I think that this was a reasonable response to that comment, and I have no problem with that on jurisdictional grounds either. In terms of the other change made in 106, I think it's really interesting in terms of Mr. Dunn's argument, and if Mr. Ramey had stricken the remaining language of that sentence, I think I would agree with him. But by retaining the language at any time to a consumer, I don't believe there's been a substantive change to that sentence of the statute. Because what it does, in effect, is what those two provisions did prior to this proposed change. One, that the prior law before this draft was that a lender couldn't lend more than $500. So if a person walks in, they could get $300, they could get $400, they could get $500. They couldn't get a $600 loan. In addition, with the language that now is shown as stricken, that for that individual, for that lender, aggregate, you couldn't have more than $500 in loans. The fact that now that language has been stricken, except for the language at any time to a consumer, it now reads, a lender shall not lend an amount greater than $500 at any time to a consumer. So what it does is it still has the maximum that a lender can give a person at any time is $500, both as a one-time event and as an aggregate. That's all that a person can have outstanding. And so I would argue that the change made is not substantive, and so according to the statute, it doesn't have to be in direct response to a comment and review and comment. And so I see really it's worded differently, but the effect of the law is the same as it was before. I don't think that that's grounds to deny jurisdiction to set a title.
Well, it's only this last change that I'm troubled by, and that was sort of my original reading. And what's odd about this is that if this change had been proposed by the industry, I have no doubt we'd be saying it was a significant change, that the whole point would be to authorize precisely what Mr. Dunn says it would authorize, which is $200 now, $200 tomorrow, and $200 on Friday. And I wish I had the annotated statutes in front of me, because I would guess that that clause that's being stricken was added at some point to the statute precisely because the previous edition had been read to authorize that sort of thing. And so at the very least, what you're doing is taking an unambiguous statute and making it ambiguous. Now, it's odd because I have no doubt Mr. Ramey is right that that is not at all what they intend. My guess is that this was done in response to that comment number 4, but was probably a mistake to make that change. And so how that fits into the statute is I'm not sure. I think they've at least opened the statute up to the reading Mr. Dunn suggests. Particularly when you change a statute in this way, the general rule is that you're doing it for a reason. And so to just say, well, we're cleaning up this superfluous language is not entirely a convincing argument. I think it now would be open to reading both ways. And I do think it, if read the way Mr. Dunn suggests it should be read, which is as a change in the law, it would be a substantive change. Now, I think it was done mistakenly in response to the comment, and so I'm not quite sure where that leaves me at this point, because I don't see it as a necessary response to what it's not a conforming amendment. It was just kind of, as I see it, they said something about a limit on the amount financed. Well, we better take out language about limits. And so I'm just not sure what to do on that point.
And I'm not sure whether it's a substantial change or not. It sounds like the intent of the proponents is not to make a substantial change, but it may be. But I tend to think Ms. Eubanks is correct that it, in a broad sense, was in response to the comments of the legislative staff.
Oh, that's not what she said.
Well, I thought because maybe I misunderstood. I thought what she was saying was because the purpose was articulated by legislative staff that gives an opportunity for proponents to revisit their language. But maybe I'm reading too much into that.
Well, I thought what she said was she didn't think it's a substantial change, and so it doesn't matter whether it's in response to a comment or not.
Okay. Well, I'm saying I don't know whether it was substantial or not, but I think either way, I think it's okay. I'm You know, I'm aware of two cases that touch upon this by the Supreme Court, and I'm not sure I'll at least mention them. I've been trying to decide how they might apply. One of them was a 1992 case dealing with Initiative Number 256, and in that case, the court allowed a change, saying that even though it was not in direct response, the court said we conclude in the context of the amendment as a whole, it was a clarification and not a substantive change. Well, I don't know that this is exactly a clarification, but again, if it's not a substantive change, it doesn't need to be in direct response. The only other case that I actually have in front of me was a case where the court threw out a measure. In that case, and let's see, this was another 1992 case, I believe, but the court said in that case, the measure, the changes differ so substantially from the original language that, in effect, it constitutes a new proposal. Well, that's a much higher standard, of course, and I'm sure the truth is somewhere, you know, the actual requirement is somewhere in between, but clearly this is not a case where it's a such a substantial change that it constitutes a new proposal. We're actually, among ourselves, even struggling whether it's a substantial change at all, and it certainly doesn't constitute, in my opinion, a new proposal. So that, you know, those cases are not conclusive, but I still at this point would be inclined to find that the board has jurisdiction and proceed to set titles. We might revisit it if there were a motion for rehearing. So I guess I'll make a motion then that the board find that number 61 comprises a single subject, and that the board has jurisdiction to set titles, and that we proceed to set titles.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Consistent with what we've done on others, let me just go ahead and then make the same motion for 62 and then for 63. And then we'll return to 61 and look at the staff draft. So for number 62, I'd move that the board find that the measure comprises a single subject and that the board has jurisdiction to set titles.
Second.
Seconded by Ms. Eubanks. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
No. That motion carries 3-0. And then on number 63, I move that the board find that the measure complies with the single subject requirement and that the board has jurisdiction to set titles and that we proceed to set titles.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. So then let's return to 61, look at the staff draft. Ms. Gomez has displayed the staff draft on the screen. Mr. Ramey, do you have any comments about the staff draft?
No, the staff draft's actually involved.
Mr. Dunn or anybody else, do you wish to comment on the staff draft? Seeing none, then I'll turn to board discussion of the staff draft. Ms. Eubanks?
In terms of the statement of single subject, it seems like the statement should be broader. I think the limitation on the interest rate actually should maybe move down because some of these other provisions that are currently described, I don't know that they specifically relate to the interest rate limitation. So in terms of the statement of single subject, whether it be more appropriate to say an amendment to the Colorado Revised Statutes concerning deferred deposit loans and in connection therewith, then talking about the limitation and the other provisions that are set forth in the staff draft.
I'd be okay if we went that route.
Okay. So I would have the language stricken starting on line one after concerning. All the way through annually on line three. And I would substitute deferred deposit loans. Loans, plural. I would move that change.
Do you want to go ahead and
do the other part
okay. of that then?
Okay. And I don't know, in terms of the language you deleted, can you copy it? Is it gone now? Or you can copy it from the ballot title and submission clause and move it up, the language we just struck about the limitation on the annual interest rate charged? All the way through annually? And then insert it after in connection therewith. And limitation would be changed to limiting. Strike on. And then on line five, after loan, change of to two. So, and then I think it might be helpful if we change the 36% to numerals and a percentage sign. So instead of spelling it out, to have actually 36%. And a comma after annually.
That would be a semicolon.
Okay, semicolon.
And that's your motion?
Yes, I have one other change, but to one of the other phrases, so I'll just do that piece.
I'll second that. Any further discussion?
My only question is whether interest rate is the right phrase. The declaration talks about interest rates, but the section 105 talks about finance charges. I don't know that it makes a difference.
Mr. Ramey, any comment?
Finance charge is probably more technically correct because it's a defined term, which is why we use it. The other thing I would point out, just language popping up twice in the same first annual, probably.
Oh, okay. So if we strike annual interest rate and insert finance charge?
Interest rate, I think, is probably more colloquially understood than finance charge, but finance charge is used in the measurement.
Okay. The finance charge charged. imposed or...
Yeah, that was Mr. Ramey's bugaboo before, and now you like
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Depends who's doing the imposing. I think imposed is right here.
Well, is it? And I don't know, maybe we don't even need to talk about lenders and consumers. Maybe we just say limiting the finance charges for a deferred deposit loan to 36% annually.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that deferred deposit loan is all that common a phrase.
I know.
But
I guess we could change it to payday loan. I mean, the measure does add that term.
It does.
Hesitant to do that?
Mr. Ramey.
Mr. Chairman, obviously we thought of that, but certainly that is an allegation of a catch phrase.
Right.
Of a catch phrase. I'd love to have it read that, but I'm not.
Take the risk.
A legal battle over.
Okay.
One concept. Matters because deferred deposit loans are to consumers. To consumers for a deferred deposit loan, perhaps? I guess what I'm suggesting is we're really talking about consumer loans here, not loans.
And that is how the term is defined in the statute, is a consumer loan.
It is a consumer loan, but when people read deferred deposit loans, they have no idea what that is.
I guess we could deal with it either to put before deferred deposit loan to say for a consumer's singular possessive, or we could say for a deferred deposit loan to a consumer, but then it sort of interrupts the rate, gets stuck hanging out there.
Certain consumer loans.
Mr. Domenico, you were wondering about deferred deposit consumer loan?
My suggestion was just for certain consumer loans and get rid of deferred deposit.
Doesn't that make it sound like it's more than deferred deposit loans? More than just deferred deposit loans?
Maybe. That's why I suggested certain, but I don't love using deferred deposit. I do think, though, that it's accurate and true. It's a little bit of a, not everybody knows what it means, but
if we're going to insert consumer, I think it probably fits better after, so that it's for a deferred deposit loan made to a consumer, whether we want to move the rate up then. So we say limiting the finance charges to 36% annually for a deferred deposit loan made to a consumer.
I like that better than the other.
Yeah, capping finance charges at 36% annually. But I think this is all right.
Since we're talking loan singular, I think consumer needs to be singular with an A before consumer. Made to a consumer.
I think the at the beginning of line four, or near the beginning of line four, can go.
Before finance charges?
Right.
Okay.
So, Ms. Eubanks, you made this motion earlier, and I seconded it, I think.
I modify my motion as the language has been amended.
So then the motion is that the first part of the title would read, an amendment to Colorado Revised Statutes Concerning Deferred Deposit Loans, comma, and in connection therewith, comma, limiting finance charges to 3.6% sign annually for a deferred deposit loan made to a consumer, semicolon.
That's correct.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Ms. Eubanks?
On line 5, I would strike the language made by a lender. It sort of seems obvious that a loan is going to be made by a lender, but, I mean, since it's clarifying what types of loans are included in that terminology, I don't think that language is necessary.
I'll second that motion.
Did I move it?
Would
so
you
moved.
Like to? And I'll second it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any other changes to the staff draft?
We need lines 7 through 10. It's not a big problem leaving it in there, I suppose, but saying, hey, no subterfuge seems a little bit like not all that important to me.
Mr. Ramey?
I mean, I think we'd prefer to have it in a big piece of this. Source of the concern with these types of I think that piece of the substance of the
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I doubt there are going to be too many voters who say, well, I would vote for this, but I don't see a provision prohibiting subterfuge and artifices, so I'm not going to vote for it, but I'm fine leaving it in there.
Is there a motion to adopt the staff draft as amended?
So moved.
I'll second. Although, and of course, the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 61. The time is 5:44, so let's turn to 62. And I wonder if we can use the same title with one change. So for 62, I think we could use the same title but change the interest rate to 28%.
Yes.
Any discussion, any testimony? I'll move that this staff draft be amended to conform to the titles that we set for 61 with the change that the interest rate would be 28% instead of 36%.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then I would move that the board adopt the staff draft as amended for number 62.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 62. The time is 5:46. Similarly, for number 63, I would suggest that we use the same title that we set for 61 and 62, except that we change the interest rate to 18%. And I wonder if I can do that with one motion, that the board adopt the for number 63 the same titles that is set for number 61 with the change that the interest rate would be 18%.
Second? Was that a motion?
That's a motion for final action on number 63, that would become the title. And Ms. Eubanks has seconded that. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 63, and the time is 5:47. Shall we take a short break? A few minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, 5-minute break?